Good afternoon again, everyone, and welcome to all of you. Just in case those of you didn't know who just spoke to you about the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, that was Mr. Southern Alberta on Council of Public Affairs. That was Gordon Campbell. This is a tremendous day for us, and we are just so pleased to see so many of you out there. And we're also apologetic to those who can't get in, but this is how we do operate. It's first come, first served, and so, you know, in this case, the early birds, I hope you don't get worms. I just hope you have a wonderful time today. We are very pleased today to be partnered with the Lethbridge United Services Institute in arranging for General Dallaire to address us on this special session. The president of the United Services Institute is Bernie Kirchmeier, who is with us today. And I would like him to stand. Also, we want to welcome many members of the Institute here as well today. Also with us today, we're very privileged to have Senator Joyce Fairburn, who is no stranger to SACPAW, but as some of you may not know, she is also the honorary colonel with the 18th Air Defense Regiment. We would also like to extend a special welcome to Dr. Howard Tennant, who is also an honorary colonel of the regiment today. So this is a very special day, as I said. We want to thank our ongoing partners of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, Erickson's, who are making the arrangements today, the Lethbridge Herald, the University of Lethbridge, and Shaw Television. To them, we are very, very grateful for our ongoing partnership. So today, diplomacy, defense, and development are the three D's of Canada's new foreign policy as announced by the government last year. These, together with commerce, are cornerstones of a strategy designed to enhance our position in the world. The responsibility to protect, which has been a Canadian initiative from the outset, is the most far-reaching agreement on the prevention of mass killing since the UN Genocide Convention was established in 1948. It seeks to ensure the protection of civilians that takes precedence over national sovereignty. It is one of the most important outcomes of the World Summit held at the United Nations last September. But will these new initiatives help prevent another Rwanda? According to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, large-scale attacks against civilians continue in Darfur in western Sudan, and the problems are growing all the time. And in Afghanistan, with Canada's ongoing military presence there on the increase, is there a clear and available political and military objectives? Is there an exit strategy? To address these and other issues today, we have a very distinguished speaker, Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire. General Dallaire joined the Canadian Army in 1964, graduating with a BSc from the Royal Military College in Kingston. He has held various command, staff, and training appointments in Canada and Germany. In 1993, he took command of the UN Observer Mission in Uganda and Rwanda, and later the United Nations Assistant Mission for Rwanda. He was awarded the Meritorious Service Cross for this mission, and on his return from Rwanda, he served as commander of the 1st Canadian Division and deputy commander of the Canadian Army. Appointed three-star general, he is appointed to various senior positions, including Assistant Deputy Minister of Defense. Since retiring, he has become perhaps even more well-known. General Dallaire retired in April of 2000, and he serves as special advisor to the Canadian government on war-affected children and the prohibition of small arms distribution. He is currently a fellow at the Carr Center for Human Rights, policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. General Dallaire was awarded the Order of Canada in 2002. His internationally acclaimed book, Shake Hands with the Devil, The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda, won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction in 2004. He was recently appointed to the Senate and sits in the Canadian Senate. Would you please join me in welcoming General Romeo Dallaire?
Well, good day, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you so much for coming out. And also thanks to the regiment, the 18th Field, and also Senator Fairburn to have received the invitation and being able to come out and spend the day here and spend a few minutes speaking with you on a subject that I believe is becoming a pertinent dimension of what Canada is. And I'm glad that we're going to bring a certain amount of discipline to this, because I'm going to be told to stop talking, we'll eat, and then we'll have questions. So I think that's a very smart way of doing things around here. I'm going to speak mostly, essentially, in a North American English, which is not my mother tongue. My mother tongue is Quebecois, or as some of my less friendlier friends from France would say, 18th century French. I'm also going to power talk, and my Marine Corps friends taught me that, so to try to get as much in as I can, and then be able to respond to questions in whatever candor that you wish to present, I will respond with equal candor. We are in an interesting situation in this country, for in this new era that we stumbled into, we are facing a decision in regards to where exactly this country is going. If we look at the recent election, one would find that we would be hard-pressed to actually identify anybody actually saying where this outfit's going. We spent a lot of time discussing our parochial, regional, internal, normal work that one would expect the government to do. But we didn't spend much time on trying to show or articulate to the Canadian youth, to us, for all the work that's been done and is still ongoing, exactly what the aim of Canada is. Is the whole system there just to keep it going, to keep it turning over, and to keep the quality of life and the standards that we have here in that sort of same scale, and as such, consider the outside world as a source for economic well-being, and when we feel like it, throw some residual assets to it through a residual international development concept versus, in fact, in this whole new era of globalism, in this new era of so much conflict, we find ourselves at a threshold of what this country should be in the world and where Canadians fit in to that. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we've seen at the end of the Cold War, and that Cold War ended in 1989, we've seen throughout the world not what George Bush Sr. said, a new world order. On the contrary, we saw a new world disorder. We saw throughout the 90s and still ongoing today, two sort of generally based conflict scenarios. The first one would be, let's say, the Somalia one. And the Somalia was a humanitarian catastrophe that had degenerated into a security problem. Hundreds of thousands of people starving, dying of thirst, drought, and so on. A country where its infrastructure totally imploded. We go in there providing assets and humanitarian aid. The warlords start to rekindle their capabilities. We end up in fighting and conflict. And those of you who saw the movie Black Hawk Down, we see American soldiers killed in the streets of Mogadishu, and what do? We pack up and leave. The American world power gets a bloody nose in a mission of humanitarianism that had absolutely nothing to do with their self-interest or security, there's no oil or anything, and turned its back to these people and abandoned the Somalis, but also the UN in its effort. And so we saw an era, at least, of this scenario, humanitarian catastrophes degenerating into security problems, with the response that I've just described, that essentially was saying that 18 white American soldiers are more important than hundreds of thousands of black Africans And as such, we can't sustain casualties in these places that have no value to us, for the only thing that's there are human beings. And as one told me at the start of the genocide in Rwanda, the only thing that's here are human beings, and there's too many of them anyways. We have that scenario, and then we saw the other scenario, which is more the Rwandan one, in which we have a security situation that degenerates into a humanitarian catastrophe. We have a civil war that builds a peace process, and we call in the classic referee that started with Pearson in 1956, the Blue Beret. And the classic referee's concept is to observe and report. Both sides want you there, so you keep an eye on things, and if somebody is not playing by the rules, well, you bring them back online, you discuss it, and you continue. And that sort of concept of having belligerents wanting peace, and in fact working through that process through a neutral observation force, we saw in this era that degenerate into total ineffectiveness also. Because we went from a peace agreement to a political stagnation, to assassinations, to riots, to small-scale massacres, to an impossible political obstruction of the moderates by extremists, to arming militiamen, to a civil war, and ultimately to a genocide that within 100 days slaughtered 800,000 human beings and made 3.9 million people refugeed or internally displaced. And during that, the world did nothing. The world abandoned the Rwandans. The world took decisions in regards to what human beings have priorities above others. Which ones count more than others? And in the 90s, in these internal conflicts that exploded throughout the world, that had been oppressed or repressed throughout the Cold War because many of these countries were led by dictators. And when the Cold War ended, we sort of said, well, get rid of your dictators and sort yourselves out. Well, these conflicts have degenerated into such scenarios, and we've let them happen. And we've picked and choosed. We have established in the world a pecking order of humanity that is more vicious than the colonial era. We've actually decided by inaction or by lack of self-interest, because there's no oil or this or that, whatever, that the sub-Sahara black African is the lowest priority of humanity. And so when the subtitle of my book, when I say the failure of humanity in Rwanda, yes, there was a failure of humanity that is the entity of humanity amongst the Rwandans by the horror and the slaughter and the raping and creating fear in order to maneuver and manipulate the population. But there was a greater sin. It was the failure of all of humanity for the Rwandans. We actually decided that we'll let them kill each other. We actually went out through the media, who were very, very light on the ground before the war, and then I couldn't keep them out during the bloodletting. We actually believed that all this was tribalism. It's in their genes. They've always done this. They slaughter each other. So we'll let them go at it for a while, and they get tired, and then we'll go in, and we'll throw some cash at it, and a few do-gooders, and then we'll let them carry on from there. We actually took that type of decision, either directly, overtly, or indirectly by inaction. And as we took that decision, we poured tens of thousands of troops and billions of dollars into ex-Yugoslavia. Who established the criteria of the difference? Who's got that sort of pecking order? Who's got that chart that says a white European is far more important than a black African? And so we will go into Europe because of our self-interest, because of our history, because in ex-Yugoslavia it was ethnic cleansing and great empires that had reconstituted themselves, and that in Africa it's nothing more than tribalism, barbarianism. Well, ladies and gentlemen, they were raping and killing and chopping off heads and mutilating in Yugoslavia just like in Rwanda. And there were more who were killed, injured, internally displaced and refugee, then raped in 100 days in Rwanda than there was in the 6 years of the ex-Yugoslavian campaign, and no one came to Rwanda. So did we learn the lesson? Have we sort of looked at that and said, this makes no sense. This is not right. Have we as a country, this country, actually looked at that and said, this is impossible. How can we here be so concerned of our human rights that we'll get incredibly upset if one of our own is abused by our judicial system, and we'll listen to this on the media and we'll react with vehemence about that. And yet on the same newscast, we'll see people being slaughtered by the thousands only 12 hours away by aircraft and not react. Can we continue to be so bicéphale? And have we continued to be so, even with the evidence? Well, let me bring you to 18 months ago about. And we have a catastrophic failure in Darfur. We have a scenario of genocide that's being launched, where hundreds of thousands of people are being abused and killing and raping and burning villages and moving them and so on. It smells like another genocide. Do we intervene? No. Is there discussions trying to stop it? Yes. Are there some humanitarian aid going in? Yes. And so it doesn't degenerate into a genocide, but still thousands are slaughtered, raped, and millions are displaced. And at the same time as this is going on, we have a tsunami. And there the media are tripping over each other trying to tell us the details of what happened to these innocent people by this natural disaster. And we are pouring billions and we're giving all kinds of money and we're sensing the innocence of those people and how they've been abused by nature. And we react to it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, at the same time as we were doing all that for the tsunami and the people who deserve, yes, to be helped, there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced, refugees, and raped in Darfur, and not a plug nickel went into Darfur. Not only that, but on the 24th and 25th and 26th of this year, the media brought it back to our attention, and it's been a year. And so we saw a whole bunch of articles and the reportage on that. Not one article on the 3.2 million Darfurians that are still living in squalor and barely surviving. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we seem to have established a certain priority of effort, a certain perspective. The problem is that we're a country that's not allowed to do it. We have stumbled into a responsibility to humanity as one of the leading middle powers of the world. We are not the small kid on the block anymore. In World War II, we put 1 million men and women in uniform out of a population of about 14 million. If you look at those of age to carry weapons and a few cheap, you know, at 16, 17 to go in, there's about 8 million of us at that time that could have worn a uniform, the bulk of them being male, and so there's half of that, maybe 4 to 4.5. One of the highest proportions of commitment of people to a conflict to rid oppression on others. And not even here, somewhere else. And yet not one of our generals sat at the highest decision bodies in that war. We were all tactical commanders. Somebody else called the shots, and we provided. And so we were the nice guy across the pond, the youthful country, full of energy and willing to take risks and available when we call them. But don't let them play in the big leagues. And that has influenced us significantly. For over the years, we have remained a tactical country. We have remained a country shooting well below our potential in the world. Well below. But there is something that's different now. Over the last 5 years, I've been talking across the country to senior high schools like this morning and undergraduates on war-affected children, on their peers in so many countries where they can't even stay in school because they're afraid of being pulled out and held as child soldiers in the bush. And what I discovered in Canadian youth is they don't have the same attitude we have. To them, we're not the young country and all the old countries are calling the shots. To them, we are a mature, yes, youthful country, late 20s, early 30s. We master technology. We have a strong work ethic. We have no ambition of subsuming anybody else or any imperial design. And we believe fundamentally in human rights and the rights of individuals. And we have the potential and the risk-taking capability of leading in the world in areas where we have that capability. And so they are asking us, where is Canada going? What are we going to do with the future, with this potential? Do we play to somebody else's tune? Do we respond to somebody else's assessment? Or in fact, do we not have, as a leading middle power, a responsibility to take a leadership role in the world, in the realm, in the world of human rights, where 80% of humanity are still in the blood and the mud and the suffering, and the 20% of the haves are off to Mars, and pretentiously saying that humanity is advancing? Well, we, by nature, are not so bicéphale. We can't disconnect the two so easily. We can't, because our nature doesn't permit us. And let me give you an example, and I'll conclude. In the genocide, at one point I was getting some troops in, finally, and I had a patrol that went into a village. And the patrol that went into the village saw essentially people all slaughtered. At the end of the village, there was what we call a rape site. Rape is now an instrument of war. It's not just some rogue guys. It's an instrument of war to create fear. It's torture. And so a lot of young girls and kids were there. A lot of them killed. Some of them are injured, extensively mutilated, and dying. And in Rwanda, there was about 30% of HIV/AIDS before the war started, before the blood lay. And so this patrol arrives there, and the question is what does the officer order the troops to do? They're all 18, 19-year-old kids. Does he order the soldiers to go into the ditch to provide a bit of solace to those who are barely alive? Maybe saving one? And in so doing, risk extensively contracting HIV/AIDS, because soldiers don't run around with rubber gloves, and they tend to cut themselves, as we know, and so on, in manual work. Or does he order the soldiers not to go in? The risk is too high. Not worth it. Don't do it. They're going to die anyways. They're dying by the hundreds of thousands. What's the difference? And so I went to the countries who had provided me troops there, and they're their contingent commanders. Because remember, the UN has no army. We lend troops to the UN. And each country then has a commander in the contingent. And so I said, what would your platoon commander do in this situation? Would he order the troops in or not? 23 of the 26 said they would not go in. 3 said they'd go in. The Dutch, the Ghanaians. In 1962, when Ghana got its independence from the UK, it turned to Canada to help it. And I trained with the Ghanaians, and we still train Ghanaians. And the third one was Canada, except there was a real problem. Because by the time the young lieutenant turned around to give the order to the troops to go in there and provide that little bit of solace at the risk of their lives, he was too late. All the troops had jumped in the trench themselves, independently. What makes us do that? What makes us do that all the time? Not only the soldiers, but the diplomats, the humanitarians, even as tourists. What in our nature makes us react to human suffering, to things that are wrong? Well, this today, our institutions, our beliefs, our communities, our values, our ethics, our legal concept of fairness, all that we inculcate amongst each other. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what has created in this country this responsibility to protect. We created that concept that no one, no government is allowed to abuse massively its own people and get away with it because it's a sovereign state. You are not allowed to abuse people innocent as whose human rights are being trashed. And in so doing, we have, ladies and gentlemen, found ourselves not only with a responsibility towards humanity, but an accountability because